Go with Greg Berg is on the way next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTV. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, a look at how we can escape tribalism. In part two, a look at a different kind of intelligence than most of us have ever thought about, physical intelligence. Stay with us. We hear so much discussion in contemporary America about the sharply divided state of our society and about the rampant presence of tribalism, of us versus them, which means that there could not be a more timely book than the book we're going to be talking about for the next few minutes, a book titled Our Moral Fate, Evolution and the Escape from Tribalism. It is a book that explores where tribalism comes from and actually offers a bit of optimistic hope that it is possible for us to escape tribalism, at least in its most destructive and counterproductive forms, that this is something that is not an inescapable part of being human. The author of the book is Dr. Alan Buchanan at the University of Arizona. Before that, the James B. Duke Professor of Philosophy at Duke University. And he has also been a professor of the Philosophy of International Law at King's College in London, England. The author of several different books, this most recent published by the MIT Press, again called Our Moral Fate, Evolution and the Escape from Tribalism. Dr. Alan Buchanan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
So my understanding is that we can trace back this phenomenon of tribalism into very, very ancient human history, but that tribalism emerged in a sense, for probably a number of different reasons, but just because it has been with us a long time does not mean we can't escape it or rise above it. First of all, is that kind of a fair summation of kind of the general sense of our relationship to this thing called tribalism?
Yes, that's very accurate.
Where would you say the impulse for tribalism comes from? What do you tie that to? Why does it occur so often in human history?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One, it's rooted in our evolved moral psychology. If you think about the environment in which our moral mind, our capacity for having a morality and for having moral judgments, when that first emerged, it was probably around 450,000 years ago, according to some evolutionary theorists, and that capacity evolved in an environment that was very harsh. There were small, widely scattered groups of human beings, and if you were in one group and you encountered somebody from another group, from another tribe, probably the most rational response and the one that was most adaptive from the standpoint of reproductive fitness was to respond with hostility, preemptive aggression, because those other people might want to kill you and eat you, or they might be carrying some disease that your group had no immunity to. So there's a reason why we would tend to sort the world into us versus them, and to have some negative attitudes toward strangers, at least in some context. Now, what really drives tribalism then is fear. And human beings, like a lot of other species, when they're fearful, they tend to herd together. And then they're looking for some object of their fear, somebody that's responsible for their being in this condition, and they tend to focus on some other kind of group. So that's why there's something deep within us that can lead to tribalistic responses. Now, there's another side of that coin, and that is that human beings also evolved to be flexible enough in their moral responses that they can respond in a quite different way. If they're not dominated by fear of the other, they can relate more inclusively. They can engage with the other. Now, the interesting thing about tribalism is that there was this original sort of primeval form of it where the us versus them is us versus people who are literally from a different society. But tribalism now has evolved, and in contemporary society, we can exhibit tribalistic attitudes toward groups that are in our own society. That's the new twist on tribalism.
In other words, the them are actually us in a way. I mean, we have Americans who are experiencing a very fierce kind of tribalism, even though at least in many respects we are all from the same tribe, but it doesn't feel like it at the moment. You tell us that in human history there have been times when humans have accomplished what you call great expansions of moral regard. These would be moments in human history, and of course they're not brief moments, moments over the course of probably long stretches of time, but where our morality, our sense of morality has demonstrated or experienced expansion. Explain what is behind your use of those words, why you want to characterize these moments in human history in this way as expansions of moral regard, and the promise that that holds for us today.
Good, good. Yeah, look, I mean, I think in the tribalistic attitude, we have the idea that there are strong moral relationships among us within our group, but people in another group are regarded as not really counting morally or not counting nearly as much as we do. So that's a kind of exclusion, and it's a refusal to include other groups in the sort of moral community that we recognize among ourselves. So if you get beyond that, if you start thinking of people in other groups as our equals and as entitled to being treated morally in just the way we are, then that's a kind of expansion of the circle of moral regard. Now, so one of the two great expansions is beginning to recognize that the other, that strangers, that members of other tribes or groups, have some kind of equal basic moral status with us. And in contemporary times, this takes the form of attributing human rights to everybody who's a human being. That's the first great expansion. The second great expansion is beginning to extend moral regard to at least some non-human animals. And this is a new thing and a big thing. Now, there have always been some moral and religious traditions that recognize that the suffering of animals is a bad thing and that we should treat them better. But it's only been in very recently in human history that kind of idea has become institutionalized, that there are laws prohibiting the bad treatment of non-human animals, for example, in medical research. So those are two milestones of human moral progress, it seems to me, the first and the second great expansion. And here's the kicker. If we were really only tribalistic by our nature, that is, if we only had the capacity to respond tribalistically, then these two great expansions would be completely mysterious. They'd be impossible. But the fact that they've occurred, at least in some societies fairly recently, indicates that our moral mind is much more flexible than this idea that we're purely tribalistic presents us as being. Hmm. So that's the source of hope. That is, we have transcended tribalism to some extent in these two great expansions, and that means that we have the potential, at least, to do something to curb tribalism.
What you do go on to say, however, in your book is that we should not be complacent about this. That is, although some people might feel differently, it is your view that this kind of progress is not inevitable. It does not just sort of happen over the course of time on its own, and that we have to, in a sense, play a role in that progress. Tell us more about the role that we have to make, or sort of the conscious effort that is involved in making progress above tribalism.
A really excellent question. Yeah, I would like to emphasize, as you said, that our escape from tribalism, and it's limited still, is fragile. It's not something we can take for granted. We can't assume a kind of Enlightenment theory of the march of progress, that moral progress is inevitable. Instead, I think that moral progress in the form of the two great expansions only occurred because of a kind of fortunate confluence of a lot of different factors in history. And we can't assume that all of those factors will continue to be in place. There are really two ways in which we can regress from the kind of inclusion that the two great expansions represent. One is if our actual circumstances degenerate to something like the harsh environment in which our tribalistic instincts were formed. And that would happen if there was a worldwide ecological crisis, a third world war, a failed state. Lots of different conditions can put us back in a situation that's analogous to the harsh environment in which we found it adaptive to relate to the other in a hostile, negative, aggressive way. The other way in which we can regress from inclusion is if we're convinced that we're in those harsh, fearful conditions, even if we're not. And the problem is that there are some people who are very good at instilling the beliefs that, in fact, the other is dangerous, that our only choice is to react hostilely toward them. This is what demagogues do. This is what propagandists do.
So what is the path that you see out of this current situation, specifically in the United States? Although we should probably hasten to add that this is not some exclusively American phenomenon at all. I mean, obviously, tribalism has played out in some really terrible and destructive ways all over the globe. But more specifically, close to home, where do you see our current tribalism springing from? What particular fears, and what sort of pathway out and upward do you see from where we are right now?
Yeah, well, I think that some people are motivated by tribalistic impulses, tend to react in a tribalistic way because they're fearful of the kinds of changes that have occurred in American society. I mean, think about it. Some of the events that you and I would probably regard as great instances of moral progress, like the civil rights movement that came closer to giving equal rights to African Americans, or the women's rights movement, we think of these things as very progressive, as just all gain and no cost. But whenever those kinds of changes occur, there are people who lose from them. That is, they lose power, they lose status. And when that happens, you've got to realize that in a democracy, those people don't go away, and you can't line them up against the wall and shoot them as you would in a revolutionary state. You have to live with them as your fellow citizens. And it's important that political parties respond to that pain and to the fear of social change that is so prevalent among some people in the population. I'm afraid that the Democratic Party hasn't done a good job of this. They haven't really responded. They tended to focus on particular groups that are historically disadvantaged by discrimination, like women and people of color, transgender people, et cetera. And that completely omits the people who are fearful and insecure because of the improvements that have been made for those groups. So I think for some people, tribalism is rooted in a kind of fear of change and a reaction to what they perceive as their change of status, the lowering of their status, because of what many of us would regard as progressive moral changes. Now, once the tribalistic attitude gets going in one group, then other groups may find it necessary, at least implicitly, to respond in a tribalistic way. You can think of it as kind of an arms race to the bottom. And this is what makes it so stable and hard to change. I mean, look, if one group, the opposition, is acting in a tribalistic way and engaging all the nasty behavior that entails, and you decide to be, you know, goody-two-shoes and refrain from that, you may be in a disadvantage. It's a little like unilateral disarmament in an arms race. You may be severely disadvantaged. There's a kind of really sinister stability to tribalism. That makes it very difficult to get out of it. But I think you have to realize that there are a couple of features about the tribalistic mentality that have to be addressed if we want to change things. One is that when you're in the tribalistic mode, you tend to exaggerate the importance of political disputes. You tend to think that you're in a kind of supreme emergency situation, that it's a winner-take-all struggle for the highest stakes. For example, think about the title of the most recent book by Sean Hannity. The title is Live Free or Die, America on the Brink. Now, that's pretty damned hysterical in my view. But the point is that if you get yourself into this framing of a situation as a supreme emergency, then you're going to be willing to do almost anything. You'll infringe ordinary moral rules that you think are not to be infringed if you think that we're in this sort of existential crisis. So that's one aspect of the tribalistic mentality. And once you get into that mode, there's something else that goes on. There's a kind of what I call clumping. That is, you clump together issues and you clump together people, right? All liberals are such and such. All conservatives are such and such. You have to buy one bundle of policies and values or the other bundle of policies. And those things are not fissionable. The tribalistic mentality is threatening to democracy because it rules out compromise and bargaining. And it does that because it relegates the opposition, the other, to a condition of being unreasonable beings, literally beings you can't reason with. I mean, think about two of the standard gambits in the tribalistic mentality. One is to regard the other as all either grossly uninformed and stupid or as irredeemably insincere and corrupt. Well, let me give you two examples of that. Think about the term that's popular in conservative circles now, libtard, L-I-B-T-A-R-D. Okay, liberals are regarded as being mentally retarded. That's the message. So mentally deficient, in fact, that you can't reason with it. The other strategy, that is attributing insincerity to the other so that you don't take their words at face value, you dismiss them because you impugn their character, that's represented very well on the right by something that Rush Limbaugh says over and over again. He says that liberals and Democrats don't really care at all about the welfare of immigrants. They want open borders because they think immigrants will vote Democratic. Now, if you buy into that, then you'll quit listening to liberals or Democrats, whatever you want to call them, who argue for easing the restrictions on migration. There'll be no point in listening to that because that's not what they're really concerned about. It's not on the merits that they're thinking about it. Instead, they just want to get Democratic voters. Now, this also occurs on the right. I mean, think about student activists who prevent speakers they disagree with from speaking on campus. They label a person as a racist or a sexist, and that's that. By sorting them into those categories, they feel they don't even have to try to reason with them. Instead, they short them down, shout them down. So this is key to tribalism. Tribalism is about not listening to what the other is saying and taking it face value. Instead, it's a matter of impugning the speaker, either as being stupid, mentally deficient, et cetera, or insincere and corrupt, and then not engaging on the substance of issues. That's crucial. There's another way to put this, and that is that tribalistic discourse is not really about genuine argumentation and seeking the truth, trying to get at what's right or what the facts are. Instead, it's mainly about what I call sorting and signaling. Sorting people into us versus them, and signaling your own loyalty to your group and its values. That's what it's about. It looks like on the surface that it's about trying to get at what's right, truth-seeking, genuine argumentation. But that's not really what's going on. Instead, it's mainly a matter of sorting into us versus them and signaling our loyalty to our group.
Mm. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Well, when this happens, as I said, because you're regarding the other as literally an unreasonable being can't reason with them, then there's no question, given that you're assuming that, you know, it's a supreme urgency, highest stakes, winner-take-all situation, there's really no point in trying to seek compromise or trying to bargain with it. But compromise and bargaining are essential to democracy. It doesn't work without that. And you don't engage in compromise and bargaining if you just regard the other as beyond the pale, things that you can't reason with, they're too stupid, they're too insincere. And that's why tribalism is a threat to democracy. But it's also a threat to the first great expansion, because the first great expansion means treating people from other groups as equals, and in particular, treating them as beings who, like us, can be reasoned with. So I think, in a way, tribalism is a kind of regression from one of the greatest achievements of human progress that we've had so far, that is the first great expansion. So, you know, it's true that tribalism threatens democracy, and that's bad enough, but I think it threatens something even deeper than that, namely what I call the first great expansion.
So if we have achieved that expansion once, you believe we can, in a sense, achieve it again or reclaim it, but I don't think you're saying it's going to be easy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the key to understanding why sometimes we're tribalistic and sometimes we're more inclusive, the key to that is to understand that how the moral mind reacts depends upon the social environment that the capacities of the moral mind get expressed in. If you're in an environment where it's either literally true that the other represents an existential threat, or if enough people think that the other represents an existential threat, then the moral mind is going to respond in this tribalistic, exclusive kind of manner. But if you're in an environment in which you don't feel threatened by the other and in which there are social practices and institutions that enable fruitful, mutually beneficial interaction with the other, then you don't get those tribalistic responses. So the key is that we've got to understand the relationship between the moral mind and the features of particular environments that influence how the moral mind responds. And if we could do that, then we could, in principle, take charge of our moral fate. That is, we could try to design our social environments in a way that elicits the best, most progressive responses from the moral mind. Now, if we could do that, and I call this moral institutional design, if we could do that, it would be momentous. It would be something entirely new in human history. It would be, I think, the highest form of human autonomy, that is, for us to take charge of what kinds of beings we are, morally speaking, what kind of morality is predominant in our society. I think it would be also a tremendous example of human creativity. So the challenge is, can we do this? Can we find out enough about how the moral mind works, how it reacts differently in different environments? And can we learn enough about how to engineer environments for this to take place? And if it did, then we would have taken charge of our moral fate, and we would have escaped from at least the worst manifestations of tribalism.
Hmm. The book again is Our Moral Fate, Evolution and the Escape from Tribalism, published by the MIT Press, the author, Dr. Alan Buchanan. Professor Buchanan, thank you so much for this thought-provoking book and this thought-provoking conversation. Best wishes.
Thank you for your excellent questions and comments. Good interview.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about a concept that on the surface might not seem to make very much sense at all. It actually makes a tremendous amount of sense. Physical intelligence. It is a concept that is explored in a fascinating new book called Physical Intelligence, Harnessing Your Body's Untapped Intelligence to Achieve More, Stress Less, and Live More Happily. And we're going to be spending the next few minutes with Patricia Payton, who is co-author of this book with Claire Dale. Patricia Payton has a consulting firm called Sphere International and has done a great deal of training and coaching, has background in both dance and voice work as well. And she and her co-author have spoken to a number of different people and explored this concept in a lot of different ways in their fascinating book published by Simon & Schuster, again, titled Physical Intelligence. Patricia Payton, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be here.
You and your co-author did not coin this term. You're careful to give credit for that to one Howard Gardner. And apparently he wrote about the idea of physical intelligence back in 1983. Tell us who he was and what prompted him to come up with this concept, which you and your co-author have explored much more deeply in your new book.
Well, I'm afraid I can't speak much on what led Howard Gardner to come up with the term physical intelligence. He wrote about it in a book called Frames of Mind, which is a theory of multiple intelligences. And he was talking about kinesthetic intelligence. So there, back in that time, you know, this was long before Sir Ken Robinson's famous TED Talk. And in Ken Robinson's TED Talk, which is related to what Howard was talking about, he described that a lot of people view their body as a vehicle that just carries their brain from meeting to meeting. It's one of the most famous TED Talks, and sadly he just passed. But that was in reference to the fact that schools were not acknowledging that there are children who are more creative, and they're thinking and learning in a different way, and they have a different type of intelligence that isn't really supported by the traditional school system. In Frames of Mind, this theory of multiple intelligences included that kinesthetic intelligence, because there's more than just cognitive intelligence or emotional intelligence or kinesthetic intelligence. There are several different intelligences, and I would encourage people, if they're interested in that, to read Frames of Mind. It's fascinating. It's actually taught at university level in many programs, and it's quite a deep piece of work, so I don't want to go too deeply into what he shared. I don't know that I'll do him justice other than to credit him with having flagged that we do have this ability, this physical intelligence that most of us ignore.
Hmm. So to help us understand this term physical intelligence, let's start with the way in which you and others are talking about the simple term intelligence. And are we talking about are you using the term intelligence in a sense the way most of us do, but then taking it further? Or is it important for us to understand right at the outset a different idea about what intelligence is?
Well, I think there are multiple intelligences. We look at physical intelligence primarily in the context of where it sits in comparison to cognitive intelligence, which is IQ, and that's the way most of us think about intelligence, as well as EQ. Emotional intelligence, and the seminal work on that was written by Daniel Goleman in the mid-90s. So we really talk about physical intelligence as not just sitting alongside those other two intelligences that are in the common vernacular, but that it underpins those intelligences. So that's how we are describing it. It's really part of a greater whole, that most of us are thinking IQ. A good number of us are thinking IQ and EQ. We're saying there's a third that should be in the common parlance. if we get into more of Howard's work, I'm sure there are all of those intelligences can be grouped together. But we're really focusing on physical intelligence as an underpinning for cognitive and emotional intelligence.
Right. And again, when you're talking about what intelligence is, these different kinds of intelligence, are we talking about then, for instance, sort of mastery or skill? In a very general term, how are you using the term intelligence and then physical intelligence?
We are using the term in terms of mastery or skill, because you can't be physically intelligent if you haven't developed the skills to do that. You can't be emotionally intelligent unless you've developed the skills to do that. You can't be, your cognitive intelligence measures your IQ. So that is how we're using it, in the same way it's used in those other contexts.
Hmm. And are you suggesting that we all have these intelligences in relatively equal measure or equal balance, or have the potential? And is that ideal, to have a balance of strong intelligences, this array? Or is it that we're all a little different, and that one person is destined to probably be more physically intelligent than cognitively intelligent, and that's okay? How should we understand this in terms of the diversity of the human race?
Sure. Well, everyone is a little different, or a lot different, and that's all right. And we absolutely, everyone on the planet has the ability to develop physical intelligence. We all have some degree of cognitive intelligence, and we all can develop emotional intelligence. So we are all at different places with regard to each one of those, I imagine. You know, everyone's IQ is different. Our EQ is up to us to develop. And physical intelligence, similarly, is up to us to develop. There are athletes we've interviewed, and artists, singers and actors, dancers, certainly, who have tremendous physical intelligence already. And then we've also worked with people in business who, at 50 years old, said, "What do you mean, focus on my breath? Doesn't it just happen?" So, you know, and yes, of course, it does happen. But if we use our breath in a more strategic way, then we can do those things that you talked about at the beginning: achieve more, stress less, live and work more happily. And breath is just one of over 100 techniques that are part of the physical intelligence curriculum. In fact, there are multiple ways of breathing that we talk about to achieve different things.
Right.
So,
before we get to all those techniques, you actually start with what you call the four elements of physical intelligence. Explain to our listeners what those four elements are and how we should think about them.
Sure. And before I do that, I'd like to just define physical intelligence so that people understand, before I get into those four and the chemical story behind them, what it's all a part of, what it enables. So physical intelligence is the ability to detect and then actively manage the balance of certain key chemicals. These are hormones and neurotransmitters that are racing through our body. And there are over 400 of those. We can't and we shouldn't influence all of them. Some of them are doing their job, keeping our heart beating. Let's not fool with those. But there are more than, we talk about eight in the book, there are more than eight, but we have to start somewhere. So eight is a reasonable number. And we can and should actively manage those through how we move, how we breathe, how we interact with each other, and how we think. So thought processes, movements, ways of breathing, ways of interacting enable us to do that so that we don't experience waves of emotion, thoughts, and reactions. We can actually strategically influence them. And it's the ability to do that, to detect and then actively manage it, that enables us to be more physically intelligent. So that's what we mean by it. And then the four elements are strength, flexibility, resilience, and endurance. Strength is all about inner strength, confidence, resolve, appropriate risk-taking, standing your ground, speaking wisely and decisively, driving change. Flexibility is all about creativity, innovation, collaboration, agile thinking, embracing change, adapting to different styles of communicating or behaving. And then resilience is just what you think. It's bouncing back from disappointment, from setback, maintaining a learning mindset, remaining optimistic in the face of challenge and disappointment, developing really strong adrenal glands and immune system through physical, mental, and physical fitness, physical, mental, and emotional fitness. And then endurance is all about sustaining effort over the long term. When you're kind of going through that, what we call an endurance tunnel, and those walls start to cave in and the light starts to dim, how do you keep those walls wide open and keep that light switched on? And that requires patience, persistence, and planning, energy, motivation. That's what we mean by endurance. So those are the four elements, and the techniques all influence the levels of chemicals, and there's a different chemical story for each one of those elements. And if we know what chemicals matter for strength, flexibility, resilience, and endurance, and then we know what techniques to use to boost those chemicals, we can take more control of how we approach a situation or react to a situation or move through a situation.
You call these four elements the backbone of physical intelligence training, and you say that these are all vital to life as a whole. Your book, of course, goes on then to explore all kinds of different techniques related to physical intelligence and to fostering it. One of the concepts you shared that I thought was really intriguing involves a very effective way to fold new habits into one's life. And it involves a process called stacking. Explain to our listeners what it means to stack new habits into one's life, and maybe give us a concrete example of what that might look like in one's life.
Sure. We call it habit stacking because what you're doing is, as you go through the book, there are 80 techniques in the book. There, as I said, there are more than 100 in our whole curriculum, and we're always creating more as neuroscience evolves. You can't take on 80 new habits as you read the book or at the end of the book. It's overwhelming. So we encourage people to choose a few and then take those, let's say, three habits and put them next to something that you already do every day, like brushing your teeth, making a pot of coffee, sitting down at your desk. If you were driving into the office in the days when we did that, you know, when you get in your car or you get on the subway or on the train, all of those things that always happen. And if you put that new technique next to the thing that always happens, it's much more quickly going to become ingrained in your daily life. So, for example, I'll give you my protocol, my morning protocol. As soon as I open my eyes, I start paced breathing, which is a foundational technique that I would advise everyone. If you only take one or two things from the book, one of them should be paced breathing. Absolutely crucial for a number of reasons. So I open my eyes and I begin paced breathing. When I get out of bed, as soon as my feet touch the floor, again, something I do every day, thank God, I do what we call a map of tension. I scan my body for where I might be holding tension, because if we free the body, we can free the mind. In fact, we cannot free the mind until we free the body. So I want to identify my points of tension and work through those. I brush my teeth, and I smile at myself. Smiling at myself in the mirror gives me a shot of serotonin, which is our happiness and status chemical. I walk across the house in what we call a winner pose to put my chemistry of confidence in place. And then as I sit down at my computer, I pay very close attention to my posture because of all of the things that posture does in terms of, again, related to confidence, but also just freeing my body for my lungs to expand so that I can breathe properly. If I'm not sitting or standing properly, I actually can't breathe properly. And if I can't breathe properly, I can't think clearly. So there's a quick protocol. I make sure I twist when I get up to make lunch, I twist at the waist. Anytime I get out of my chair, I twist at the waist. That releases serotonin. 95% of that is produced in our gut. And it's very important for the suppleness of the connective tissue between muscle and bone. And again, that serotonin is our happiness chemical. So it helps in flexibility in many ways, physical flexibility, mental flexibility, serotonin. There are other chemicals that also impact flexibility. So there are a few things that I've habit stacked into my daily life. And then other techniques you might want to use situationally, but the habit stacking is crucial to get some of those daily practices in your day.
Mm. And I appreciate what you just did, because it gives us a very good sense of just how detailed this book is in terms of exploring the four elements and many elements within each of those elements, and very concrete ways to underscore them in one's life and nurture them. Let's talk for a moment about chemicals. We've touched on chemicals quite a lot already, and it's interesting how the chapter in which you kind of introduce us to the importance of this is titled The Winning Cocktails, in which you talk about, I think it's 8 chemicals that are of particular importance when it comes to our physical intelligence and our well-being. And then you talk about the concept of mixing the cocktail, that is, that these 8 chemicals are not just important in and of themselves, but they're also important in terms of how they interact with each other and are balanced with each other. Just say a word about just how significant this is, and give us a general sense of how an ordinary person can be in a position to make a difference when it comes to those kind of matters that most of us are walking around not thinking about at all.
Sure. So let's start with 2 quick chemicals, which are adrenaline and acetylcholine, that really work in balance. So most people are familiar with the feeling of adrenaline, right? It gets us up, it gets us going, and the acetylcholine brings us back into balance. So they're 2 ends of a scale. If you think about that as a vertical axis, there we toggle. We go from the adrenaline for effort and the acetylcholine for balance. That's a vertical axis. There's a horizontal axis that has cortisol on the right and DHEA on the left. Cortisol is our stress and threat chemical. It gets a bit of a bad rap because we need it to get up and out of bed in the morning. We all need cortisol. But if it spikes too high, then it brings all of our top-performing chemicals down. And if we don't have enough DHEA, it goes too high. So DHEA is our vitality chemical. That's at the other end of that axis. I can't show the picture, unfortunately, but if you're drawing it in your mind, DHEA is our vitality chemical. And that's why I talked about paced breathing being so important, because DHEA is so powerful that in synthetic form, it's a banned substance for Olympic athletes. But we can produce it on our own every day through paced breathing. So that's why I say if you take one technique, start with paced breathing, which also requires posture, so they're joined at the hip. When DHEA is where it needs to be, then all of these other chemicals are in balance. The dopamine, our pleasure and reward chemical, oxytocin, our social bonding and trust chemical, serotonin, our happiness and status chemical, and testosterone, our power and control chemical. So if cortisol spikes, those all come down. If DHEA is where it needs to be, then they're all well supported, and cortisol is at the optimal low levels where we need it to be in our body. So that's what we mean by mixing that cocktail. If we engage in certain behaviors, as I said, smiling at ourselves in the mirror, that takes seconds. Incorporating certain twists in our day, then we're releasing serotonin. Oxytocin, so important for social bonding and trust. And this year, a lot of people are really low on oxytocin because we haven't been able to spend time with our loved ones the way we normally can. So oxytocin is so important for performance in multiple elements, flexibility, resilience in particular, and we need to keep that boosted. So there are certain techniques that will create a release of oxytocin, which is produced in our brain, but also by independent neurons in our heart, in and around our heart. So all of those must be where at optimal levels for us to do just what the book says, achieve more stress less and live and work more happily. If we know what they feel like, and if we know which techniques will release them, then we can more strategically approach incorporating these thought processes, movements, breathing techniques, and ways of communicating into our day.
Last question. Your book includes real-life examples from the lives of some athletes and some dancers and some singers and so on. For someone who is not, for instance, an athlete at all, is this within their grasp to the same extent that it is for someone who, for instance, is athletically blessed, athletically gifted, and very much in touch with their body in a way that the typical non-athlete probably is not? I mean, are we talking about an arena that, in a sense, has nothing to do with the gifts that we think of with the typical athlete?
Absolutely. This book is for every human being on the planet. No matter where you are, there are techniques that you're going to be able to use. We have wheelchair users who are using physical intelligence. There are. We were speaking at the Oxford Literary Festival, and there was an elderly woman who was frail, and she said, "How is this for me?" And we sat with her and talked to her. We said, start where you are. Most of us are breathing on our own. I know that's not true of everyone, but most of us are breathing on our own. Most of us are able to sit and stand and walk, right? If we're, and the simple act of walking is going to release some dopamine, which is going to help you with creativity and innovation. That's a Stanford study, 45% more likely to have a creative, innovative idea if we're walking versus seated. Sitting, standing, smiling at yourself at the mirror, twisting at the waist. Those are things most people can do. So absolutely, it's tremendously accessible. It doesn't cost anything. These are all abilities within ourselves. There are also tips and techniques for ways of exercising to help us in each of those four pillars, and ways of eating to help us in each of those four pillars. So now some of that might require investing in some equipment and certainly buying the right food, but the majority of the techniques are things that any of us can do any day without spending a penny. And it will drive performance. In fact, companies that have invested in this have achieved double-digit revenue growth. They've increased operating efficiency. They've improved their customer satisfaction and employee satisfaction scores. Individuals have been promoted up one and two levels within months, and in some cases even weeks, of really putting this in place on a team or within themselves. So it works, and it's simple. But don't confuse simple with unimportant. This is vitally important for our performance and largely overlooked.
The book again is titled Physical Intelligence: Harness Your Body's Untapped Intelligence to Achieve More, Stress Less, and Live More Happily. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and one of its authors, Patricia Payton. Patricia Payton, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. This has been an illuminating conversation for me, and I'm sure for our listeners as well. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. And people can find us at companiesinmotion.com or Payton_Patricia, that's Peyton_Patricia, on Twitter. And I'm on LinkedIn as Patricia Payton. So love to hear from you. Follow us. We'll send you the latest tips in neuroscientific research with easy techniques.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll be meeting television writer Paul Robert Coyle, who wrote for shows as varied as The Streets of San Francisco, all the way to Hercules, The Legendary Journeys. His memoir is called Swords, Starships, and Superheroes. On Wednesday, we'll be previewing two really special holiday events coming up virtually, of course. Ye Olde English Christmas Feast from the Kenosha Unified School District. And we'll be speaking with Polly Amborn and John Chape and Brian Lynch, who are part of that. Also, we will highlight for you the upcoming signature spotlight concert from the Racine Theater Guild, which is titled Home for the Holidays. On Thursday, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program, and we'll be talking, of all things, about salt and the importance of salt in our daily lives. Allison Madison is with Wisconsin Saltwise, and we'll be hearing about Salt Awareness Week, which comes up in early January. On Friday, yet another holiday tradition, A Christmas Carol, and an intriguing virtual production of that from Fleeing Artists Production that is going to be shared next week with the public. We'll talk with the director.